Okay, good morning, members of the gym. Thank you for being online. Great, thanks, Melissa. I'm going to go ahead and call us to order. And Nicole, if you can do the roll call, please. Baker Long, present. Nate Bauer.
Present.
Jed Olson.
Present.
Karen Sinforo. Kirkland Wall. Alden Morris. Jamie Warwick. Jesse Cynthia. Sue Mitchell. And Wendy Brooks. Chris, I think that's probably my mic that's not working real well. Chris Brooks, Jim Grossbow,
yes.
Matthew Blunt,
yes.
Susie Fry,
yes.
Stacy Havishaw, Brandon Moreira,
yes.
Katie Miller, Jessica Armstrong,
yes.
Julie Nelson, Kara Ash,
yes.
Tina Jala,
yes.
Jessica Howard, Kim Newton,
yes.
Brad Chris,
here.
Thank you. Nina Sitchikov,
yes.
Janelle Merrifield. Charles Sandrin for Amanda Wall. Melissa Parks.
Here.
Thank you, Melissa. Trish Winters. Connie Heisinger and Connie Online. Samara Taylor.
Okay.
He writes his name, I did not call. All right, our first item is approval of the staff council meeting number 274 agenda. Do I have a motion?
Thank you.
Any edits or additions to the agenda today? Okay, hearing none. Any opposition to approving the agenda? All right, we have an agenda.
Thank you.
Next up is approval of the consent agenda, which includes approving the staff council meeting number 270 minutes, that's from the April 2016 meeting, and approval of the staff council meeting 272 minutes from the June meeting. Okay, sorry, just 270, not 272. Okay, so then I have a motion to approve the staff council meeting 270 minutes. Thanks, Kim. Thank you. Okay. Any edits to those minutes? Any opposition to approving the minutes? All right, minutes are approved. Thank you. Next up, green dot minutes. This is something that we started doing last year, just to take a moment to talk about any kind of green dot issues or thoughts or ideas that people have, or just to take a moment to acknowledge that we want to be a safe and welcome community. So if anybody has something to share now. Okay, so I'll move on to pending actions. You'll recall that staff council passed promote a resolution proposing changes to EUA regulations for the review of layoff or recall decisions. And primarily, the request was to change it. So it explicitly stated that whoever conducted or whoever laid you off did not conduct the review, and to have a timeline based on when the employee requested the review. And then down the line, I passed the resolution as well, basically just supporting the UAS resolution and moving it forward. And we did last week get a response from President Johnson and legal counsel regarding those changes at which they are declining to make. And so the memo is attached outlining the reasoning from general counsel on those items. So as far as the governance process goes on that, that pretty much is the end of the loop. So I think we have now repeatedly communicated that these are things that we are concerned about, one, that it happens in a timely manner, and two, that it's done by the appropriate people. So on the having it conducted by the appropriate person, their position is, of course, we would never have the person who laid someone off be responsible for conducting the review.
If we hear that that has happened, then I think that's something we might act on. But in the meantime, I can see the understanding is clear on their end that shouldn't be happening, certainly. And then on the timeline, that's not something that they're willing to put in because there's the potential for that to just not be possible with workloads, depending on the scope of layoffs in some areas, or if many people challenge them all at once, they might not have the staff to get through 50 appeals in, 30 days. So that's that item. Any comments on that?
I just encourage people to be vigilant, pay very close attention without any example. I mean, I think that these requests came from a place of, I think, pretty good and strong and realistic imagination for what could go wrong in this process, absent the policy changes that we advocated for. Now without those changes, I think it's important to pay close attention to any kind of these processes that do occur, so that there are examples of, what we anticipated, I think, I think it's important that we know about them.
Okay. UAS Emergency Action Plan Policy Review. This is something we shared back before the summer break, that it hasn't been finalized yet. I haven't received any feedback, so I would like to set a timeline on that so that we can get back to leadership. So I'd say if you do have any comments on that UAS Emergency Action Plan Policy, to please get those submitted to me within the next 2 weeks. And then if there is feedback, I'll either consolidate it or just pass it along verbatim to Kari so she can get that incorporated. Any questions or comments there? Then item C and D here, I think, were possibly pending when we left off before the summer break and were finalized, which was the changes to the definitions for extended temporary employees. And so I think we discussed that pretty heavily in the past. Nothing has really changed with that except that it is final at this point, and that was extended temporary employees are a very specific category that was narrowed. It was sort of the conditions for it were tightened, and then it was clarified that sick leave extended temporary employees don't sick leave. Right. Sorry. It's been so long on that one. So I'll be taking those off the agenda going forward. we have anyone here for public comment today? Did you see that note from Chad on the audio, Nicole? Sorry, Chad, we'll see what we can do about it. Any idea why we might be having an echo?
Are there others online that are experiencing that echo issue?
You can hear it over here in the speaker.
Really?
Is the echo any better now? That seems worse. Okay. Sorry, guys. Yeah, now we can hear it in the room, too.
I think it sounds kind of cool.
Is it still? Yeah, it is still going, isn't it? Yeah.
It's better over here, though. Try again.
Is it better now? Is it better now online? No. Chris is suggesting that we move our speakers. Yeah, so Chris, our concern is if we mute the speakers, we won't be able to hear anything you have to say. I guess we could unmute if you type in that you have a comment. He's not in the room.
Maybe if everybody in the room just called in on their phone.
Testing. Nope. Testing. Testing.
can't hear from here, so I don't know if that's worse or better.
Is it better than it's over?
Is this better online, or is it still pretty bad?
You can keep talking, that would help.
I'm just going to keep talking while Nicole fiddles this thing. And I'll try not to talk about anything important. So people online don't miss anything. Did everyone have a nice weekend? That weather sure was swell. That's better, Chad? Is that better online? Yes? Yeah? Have we solved it?
Nice.
All right. Thank you, guys. Sorry about that. Okay. So let's return then. Do we have anyone for a public comment, either online or in the room? No? All right. So I'll move along into officers' reports. Most of the things that that I would report on really are covered under unfinished business and some of those other items, so I'm not going to take very long here. I did want to note that Staff Alliance had their retreat this over the course of the summer. No problem, Evelyn. I'm glad you could join us. We have just spent the last 10 minutes figuring out audio, so you haven't missed much. So we had the Staff Alliance retreat over the summer, and I'm very pleased to announce that the new Staff Alliance chair is Nate Bauer. I think we're really lucky to have Nate in this role, and we're a unanimous vote, so we were really, really happy. And the vice chair will be Colleen James from UAS. She's in their sort of the equivalent of Rural Student Services, and so I think she'll have a really good perspective as well for Staff Alliance. And one of the outcomes of that, before I turn over to Nate for his report, one thing we did really want to stress at Staff Alliance was increasing participation in public comment for the Board of Regents meetings. You probably got the several communications about the changes to the Board of Regents testimony, moving that to the call-in option, a week to 2 weeks ahead of the meeting, which I think will be interesting. It's not quite the same as being there in the room face-to-face with people, but it does mean that when the meetings are in Anchorage, we here in Fairbanks can participate in public comment, and that our folks at the rural campuses and our other remote sites have the option to actually give public testimony, which never has really been the case before. Usually the Board of Regents would meet once a year at some campus other than Juneau, Anchorage, or Fairbanks. And so it was usually several years at a time in between visiting any specific campus for testimony. So they weren't hearing from people in those areas, and they had no option for distance testimony. So I think this is an improvement in increasing the diversity of perspectives that the regents are hearing from, but we do want to make sure that we're taking advantage of it, and it can be a little harder to remember when they're not physically here in front of you to call in. So I'll just encourage people to keep an eye out for the next opportunity to call in, and we'll try and send out reminders as well. And then if there's an item to comment on, please do so. There's a couple other opportunities to provide feedback as well that we'll talk about under single accreditation and strategic pathways, but I also want to really encourage people to take those opportunities to provide feedback where we can.
Hey, thanks, Faye. I would echo a lot of what Faye had to say. I think that the Board of Regents call-in testimony is a work in progress. I think that it worked, from what I could tell, pretty good the first time. It was last Monday. It definitely was clear that the amount and the diversity of the folks calling in terms of faculty, staff, students, especially community members, university community members, whether those are in Anchorage or Fairbanks or elsewhere, there was large participation. I think they filled up most of the time. As an FYI, you can listen in to those testimony periods through, I think, KUAC2 has a live feed online, which is nice and good, and I commend them for that. So just think about that in advance of next month's Board of Regents meeting. We'll have lots of new information about structure and processes in the university system between now and then. But to use that, I think typically it'll be like the Monday before the week of the Board of Regents meetings. And we'll make sure to send out notices and just kind of reminders about that. But we have, especially at UAF, also across the university system, we have a incredibly good and talented and diverse set of staff people who have just a really wide range of experiences and knowledge and access to the different aspects of the university system. And so reflecting that, I think, to our systems administration is increasingly important. And I always encourage people, like Bay said, it's a major goal of Staff Alliance this year to increase participation from staff everywhere across the university system. So that definitely applies here at UAF. And then the only other thing that I wanted to mention is just to recognize at this forum within this group the death of Erica Asseri. She was a staff person here, and I didn't know Erica personally, but I have talked to loads of people who did and had just tons and tons of wonderful things to say about her, and it's a major loss. And I think that we haven't, to my knowledge, had formalized processes of trying to collate staff recognition of losses like that. But the chancellor was good to send out a message with her family's contact information last week. So I just encourage people to, if they had a personal relationship with Erica, or if they, recognize her loss in a personal way, I would encourage them to forward those concerns along to her family.
There is a room set up on second floor, Eielson, on the greening side. It's the very last room. If anyone would like to share thoughts or memorial, there's a guest book and a space to write comments.
Thanks, Jane.
I think this is probably also a good time to remind people that we have grief counseling available as well. If this is something that's impacting you, that the employee resources that we get, that is available. So if you need someone to talk to, or a professional to talk to reach out to, that's on the UAHR website as well as your benefits.
That's all I have.
All right, so moving on to governance reports. Colby? Hi. Thank you, I think.
Bit of a different format. We've changed around. It changed around a lot, so you can see. Hello, everybody. For those of you who don't know my name, I'm Colby. I have the privilege of serving as the student body president for this academic year. You've seen many faces from student government throughout the past year, and whether you like it or not, you'll be seeing me for this year. So I will be the constant face, time permitting. This morning, before I came here, I took a look over your agenda, and I'm always impressed at the progress and the work you do. Not only outside of just your jobs, which is difficult enough, you do this service to the university. And I would just like to thank you for the work that you do in your day jobs, making sure I can access my education, but also in the service to this community. Times are very difficult, and particularly I think it's difficult for staff. So thank you for, even through this time, having the courage to continue serving the university. I really appreciate it, and my fellow students do too. Last year, at the beginning of the year, I gave a quick overview of the services ASUAF provides to students. I'll just do that now because I'm seeing lots of new faces. ASUAF provides things like free printing and faxing for students, free coffee. You can go downstairs and get coffee right now. We also provide free legal services and advocacy and representation to students. So if you do run into a student who has an issue, an option would be to send them down to our office, which is right downstairs by the bowling alley. So now that I've covered that, I'll get into the meat of my report, which is the two kind of focus areas students have been talking about and the two issues that student government is taking up. The first of which is athletics and strategic pathways as a bigger picture. If you were at the forum where we heard from Grandma Nanook, I think it's clear to anyone there to see that there are plenty of pros and cons on the athletics debate. On the one hand, athletics does enrich our education. Student-athletes perform very well academically, and it's a part of a holistic college experience. On the other hand, of course, as Tammy Wilson points out, it's very expensive. So if I could just take a step back from that debate just for one moment and try to point out a third perspective that I think is often missed, and that is of the individual student-athlete. When the university makes decisions to cut a program, it's a very often a very long trajectory decision. We think about the impacts of the budget down the road, and to some extent, that's very valid. When we cut an academic program, we have a teach-out plan in place, and students are able to complete their education. Student-athletes are not afforded that protection. While athletics isn't an academic program, it is very much tied to students' academics. We have student-athletes have scholarships tied to the academics. It's a very, very compelling reason why a student would choose the university. In fact, we have a new basketball player that just graduated from West Valley that decided UAF over other options that he had. So when our university leaders are making decisions, I encourage us all to keep the perspective of the individual student-athlete in mind, that they themselves will be impacted, not just the university as a whole. So I would just ask that when through our discourses that we have, that we keep that perspective in mind of the individual student. The second main issue that students are talking about is the new EverFi's Haven Online Healthy Relationship and Alcohol EDU training. Students supported and have supported a some sort of mandatory training, and I applaud the university for using its authority to promote a healthy environment on campus. I think ignorance plays such a big role in the campus safety issues that we have, and being able to address that is very important. With that being said, the training that was implemented, students raised some specific concerns about. Number one, the training is not truly mandatory. You only have to pay a fee, and then you don't take a course. It's not like you absolutely have to, otherwise you can't be part of this university. The second is that the penalizing fee is not equitable. $150 fee for someone for a student who is affluent or has access to financial resources is not, will not present a significant financial burden. However, a student who is of low income or has little access to financial resources will face a huge burden with a $150 fee, so it's not equitable. Three, it's cumbersome to complete. It's quite long, which I don't think is a bad thing, but there is a 30-day gap, and I understand that there is some reason for it, but to the average student's perspective, it's a bit arbitrary, the 30-day gap between Section 1 of the training and the second portion. And lastly, there wasn't student support for the fee. Students would rather see an incentive like a registration block that would truly make the training mandatory, or some other form of incentive or requirement, because there just isn't support for a fee from the students. So I will cap off my report there, and I would just like to briefly touch on Erica's passing. The Japan Alaska Club, you may have seen this if you walk through the Wood Center sign, the lower level where the cafe is, on Friday folded 1,000 paper cranes in Rumi of Erica. Just that alone, I think, shows to the impact that Erica had on students. It's often thought of that faculty can impact a student's education and students' lives down the road, but I think staff very much have that capacity and that role in students' lives as well. And Erica definitely filled that role for many students. We will be passing a resolution in honor of Erica this coming week, and we'll be distributing it campus-wide. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Go ahead, Brandy.
Has ASUAF spoke to anyone regarding the implementation of the fee for the Haven training? What's being done?
Yes. Early in the summer, initially student government wasn't consulted at all in these discussions, so it was a bit of a surprise, as many things often are, especially over the summer. I met with Dean McCullough over the summer and created a plan to be involved in the implementation. We're still working on that. I drafted a letter to Vice Chancellor Spriga to discuss those 4 points that I brought up, and we had a productive one-on-one meeting. I'll be reporting to the Faculty Senate today and asking for a single credit course that students would have to take their first semester at UAF that would cover the things that are covered in the Haven training.
Thanks, Colby. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Trish. This is the first semester that it's being rolled out, Trish. It was rolled out last fall.
It's now mandatory.
The mandatory part is new this semester. As far as staff council taking a look at it, I think my preference would be to sort of follow ASUAF. Lead, so if there's a place where you feel it would be helpful for us to do a sort of resolution of support of something that you're doing in a governance-to-governance relationship. But I think that if there are concerns that staff specifically have about the way implementation is affecting staff and our ability to do our jobs, if we're seeing impacts directly to staff, I could see something doing something on our own. If it's more we think that we want this to be a good experience for students and to be important for students, then I would rather follow the lead of ASUAF. Jessica, did you have?
I do. I just think that the communication to staff has been lacking about the training and about the ramifications. I really like the idea of the one credit class. I think that would be useful, or making it a positive thing instead of a punitive thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there should be more communication from whoever is spearheading it to staff so that they can provide support to students, because there was one message in the Cornerstone, and I think that's the only communication that has gone out to staff about the training.
Colby, I had a question. You mentioned a 30-day gap or lag or something, and I didn't understand. Can you explain what that was?
There are two sections to the training. You complete the first for new students, were intended to complete the training before they got to campus. The second portion of the training has to be completed September 30th. Can anyone help me on that? I think September 30th or October 30th, one of the two. And there's a 30-day gap between the two sections. So once you complete the first section, you have to wait 30 days until you complete the second section. I can't speak as to why.
I can sort of speak a little bit to it. I was working residence life, and a lot of this came from our kind of world. But the point of it is that if you take all the training at once, the retention is pretty low, and that the second part is obviously introducing a little bit of new information but reinforcing the old concepts after you move in. And it's in an effort to really get those concepts to stick in people's minds, and that was on a recommendation of the company who produces the training.
Right, thanks. I didn't know that. That's important to have that information. Thank you.
It sounds like
that including that piece in the communication, the intent of the 30-day gap might be helpful to students as well in alleviating some of the frustration about the gap. Mm-hmm. Because if it seems arbitrary, then it's going to be a frustrating experience as opposed to a learning.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that there are different audiences, and different audiences are being communicated to in different ways, mm-hmm. so that information may be out there, but of the people I've talked to, that hasn't been abundantly clear.
I do have a quick question about the athletic, your particular group's involvement with that conversation. I know from my perspective in South Council, I don't know if we've been as a group terribly engaged in that conversation. I just didn't know what kind of opportunities you were having as ASUAF to comment on that, or if it's just you taking more of a side role, if anybody's approached you for any kind of comments about that. I just don't want us to miss out on an opportunity to engage staff council.
Right. I think the two great opportunities were the forums that we had, and if you were there, you saw the field of Nanic jerseys in the back, or off-field. You saw the athletes back there. I think that showed involvement. Student government is, of course, like every other group, kind of just getting rolling. Student group just getting rolling at the beginning of the year. Over the next week or so, we'll have surveys and tabling opportunities for students to voice their opinion to us. When students do come to us with concerns, we urge them to go to the president's office website, where there's opportunities to provide feedback there as well.
Any other questions online for Colby? All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now we have the faculty summit report.
Yeah, excuse me, thank you. So this afternoon is our first meeting at the Senate, and we're going to, it looks like a relatively light agenda. We've been mostly juggling changes to the Senate body itself. But we do have a resolution on the agenda, basically supporting Chancellor Dan Thomas's accreditation report, basically looking at moving to single accreditation versus staying at multiple accreditation system-wide as we have now. And basically, the resolution is in support of the findings that single accreditation is really not necessary to achieve significant savings. That said, there's a number of other recommendations in the report, and the gist of that is basically any attempts to align efforts across the campuses is very favorable, because there's a lot of pressure from Board of Regents on down to align the activities of the campuses. And so one of the things we're going to look at is aligning the credit for prior education across the three campuses. So that's one of the things we think we can tackle right now. Also, we have kind of a peek in the strategic pathways process. I was on the Research Administration Committee for Strategic Pathways, and all the reports are online. If you have any feedback on the process or the findings, I do encourage you to submit that through the web-based form, which is basically what we have as faculty as well. But I will point out that it's a very, very rapid process, and so our task on the review was to look at the various options for, say, consolidating research administration at one campus and look for cost savings, but the process is so rapid and it's really such a complex process that we can list options, but we really can't consider savings or risks in implementing those options. And so those are sort of the two things that are on my mind right now. Thank you.
Any questions? Any questions online? All right, thank you. All right, moving on to unfinished business.
The first item on there was the mentoring interest survey. And Jamie, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is just a pending item that was sort of on hiatus over the summer. Great, thank you. The next item was the Chancellor search update. So I think everyone is aware that Dana Thomas was appointed interim chancellor the letter was on July 1st. He's now in that role. The transition has happened. I think for those of you who aren't familiar with him, Dana Thomas has a long and well-respected history with the university, from faculty through administration. He was also in his last formal role with the university as vice president for academic affairs at statewide. He was responsible for system governance as well, so he does have a strong respect for governance and for those processes, and I think has made it clear that he's eager to engage with governance and really does have a good understanding of the role of governance and when to consult with governance, and I find that promising. And he made in pre-staff the other day also made it clear that he wants to kind of ensure that he's giving equal attention to the different governance groups, and I think he recognizes that it's sometimes easier for staff council to be less in the loop on some items than Faculty Senate, for example, just because of the nature of the university. So I'm certainly looking forward to working with him this year, and then we'll see where it goes after this year. I think we're still unsure. I know some of that will depend on what the regents decide to do as an outcome of the accreditation report and those thoughts, and then what they'll decide to do in terms of filling this permanently or not having it or filling it indefinitely for a little while longer. So that the ultimate future of the position, I think, is still up in the air, but I think we'll be in very good hands for the next year with Dana Thomas. Any comments or questions there? Okay, strategic pathways. So like Colby and Chris have both mentioned, the phase one group has been a very fast process. Most of it occurring over the summer when it is very hard to engage staff, faculty, and students in the process. The governance involvement in the first phase was that there were system governance representatives on each of the review teams, and so that those first phase review teams were athletics, research administration, procurement, IT, engineering, management, and education. And so Nate and I were both on teams. I was on the management team. Nate was on the research administration team. It was a process of two full-day meetings that were spread out, and then kind of weekly check-in calls, and then the final report being presented. So it was not a lot of time to put into some of these really big, hefty issues. And the president was also very clear in his thoughts on what the governance representative's role was, basically, which was to really be able to keep kind of governance perspectives in mind, but not to be doing polling or trying to get a consistent perspective to present. So he was pretty clear to us on that we should not be saying, here are the options that are being discussed. Let me gather a staff perspective on School of Management and bring that to the team. It was that through system governance, we should have enough general understanding to speak to the issues, but that we weren't supposed to be doing any further outreach. The communication was supposed to be managed by the communication team specifically. So that
was an interesting perspective, and then that I think the teams discussed things a little differently. My team, especially the deans, were very concerned that the options not be put out there until the report, because they were very concerned that if there are things that we were kind of kicking around as brainstorming ideas that weren't realistic, those could have very real impacts to enrollment. So if students were seeing something like get rid of UAS altogether, that would be pretty devastating to UAS if it wasn't a real option. So they wanted to avoid issues like that, which I think particularly in the academic areas was a real concern. So we did express multiple times concern about the very narrow timeline between the reports being made public and then the opportunity for public comment to the Board of Regents, and that, you know, also with the timeline coinciding with semester start and people coming back on contract and students coming back, that that it was going to be difficult for people to really wrap their heads around it and give a lot of good feedback on this one. I would say there is certainly still time to submit feedback on each of those reports through that form. There's also the regents won't be acting on the president's recommendations at the September board meeting. He will be presenting them to them, so I certainly encourage you all to watch that meeting, because those of us on the team still are not sure what his recommendation will be. The teams didn't make recommendations. They analyzed options and said, here are the options. Here are potentially the pros and cons of each option, period, not recommendations. So I believe the president will be presenting his recommendations to the Board of Regents at the September meeting. So I would strongly encourage everyone to watch that and then to provide public testimony at the next Board of Regents meeting, which is when they'll be actually acting on adopting those recommendations or some other plan as an outcome of that conversation. The next set of Strategic Pathways teams should be kicking off fairly soon here. And Nate, did you want to speak to the team process for that a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think... From Alliance, from Staff Alliance perspective, we have sought the ability to recommend individual staff members from outside of Staff Alliance, partially because Staff Alliance is a small group. You know, there are only eight of us, and I think just about all of us played a role in the Phase 1 reviews. And they are particularly time-consuming and energy-consuming, so I don't think that we have the resources to devote to every single stage from among these, like, eight people. So, and then secondly, we feel that we have staff people at our disposal among our different staff council groups at the campuses and statewide level, that may have more expertise and experience with these particular review areas of Phase 2 of Strategic Pathways and forward from there. So the Phase 2 review teams include community campuses, e-learning, health, fisheries, human resources, institutional research, university relations, and student affairs. And we're still awaiting specific timelines for those, but we will be recommending individual from the Alliance level, from the system-wide level, we will be recommending individual staff members and contacting you early this week, actually, and forwarding those recommendations along to university administration, who has agreed to endorse this kind of recommended representative process.
So, yeah, we're pretty pleased with that as a change. With the appointments to the first round of Strategic Pathways review teams, we sort of found out at the same time everyone else did. It was on the Board of Regents presentation, you know, oh, you're on this team doing this thing, which was fine, but I think
there were certainly some areas where we thought, you know, wow, if someone else had had this opportunity, they might have had more familiarity with the topic at hand. Some of it just worked out pretty well. You know, Nate's in a research unit. He was on research administration. I'm a UAS School of Management alum. I was on the management team, and I work in management. So there were some that were kind of made sense and worked, but there were certainly opportunities where we thought someone who works more closely in that field might have had a more meaningful experience. And with this second round of topics, there's a lot on this list that's not represented at Staff Alliance in terms of membership. So I'm glad that we'll have the opportunity to put names forward. So again, please look at those reports, use the feedback form, submit that, but then don't stop there. So that feedback goes to the president. So I would use that fairly quickly because the president will be presenting to the Board of Regents September 15th and 16th. But then also be prepared for the next round of public testimony to the regents before the November meeting. If there's something you feel is missing from the reports or something that you feel quite strongly about, please use that testimony option because it'll be a board decision, particularly for the academic programs. That'll really require board action. The administrative items, and I would include athletics in that piece, the administrative items, IT, research administration, procurement, I believe the president can make those decisions without the board involvement, and the board will be much less invested in those decisions. It's just something that they care less about than academics and athletics. So I would say, for those ones, focus on getting that feedback form in. For the academic ones and athletics, use the form, but also board testimony. Certainly board testimony could be effective for the administrative ones as well. I just, my read on the board over the last year has been that's not where they're going to be particularly concerned. So moving on to budget update. Following over the summer, we did manage right up before the end in a surprise conference committee move. They actually moved us to a higher dollar level of funding than either the House or the Senate had put forward. They bumped us up to $335 million for the university, which was great news. And so the president then had the budget distribution plan. And we certainly heard from people on that. The concern was we thought at the university, certainly staff at the university had an impression that we were planning for a $325 million cut means this, a $300 or a $325 level funding package means this for UAS, a $300 level cut or funding package means this for UAS. It came in at $335 at the time, and the president said, well, you're going to get the $300 level, and then I'm going to use the rest for these strategic initiatives. And that money will go back to the campuses, but it'll go back in these strategic areas and not just across the board. So I think a lot of people were surprised by that approach and felt that that wasn't necessarily what they'd been advocating for to the legislature and were frustrated. And we communicated that as well, both to UAS leadership and to the president directly, that process and that decision, I think, should have been communicated before it was a Board of Regents decision, that people shouldn't have been surprised by that outcome. So after that was in place, the governor did veto $10 million back out of our budget. As part of a whole package of vetoes. I'll say he vetoed us less than he vetoed others, so we were still seeing some protection there. That $10 million is coming out of the president's strategic initiatives pot. It's not being distributed further as a cut. So he's just using less money right now for some of those strategic initiatives. And those include things like some deferred maintenance, which UAF desperately needed, part of a funding package to secure bonding to finish the engineering building so that that can actually be used. Some Title IX issues, positions, some president's professors in kind of key areas. That's actually just starting now, the sort of call to departments or to deans to say, here's an area where if we got the right faculty member in, we could really set ourselves up for success down the road. So it's sort of looking at investing in a few tenure track positions that could have, you know, real positive impacts. A couple other small items, donor development.
Student recruitment and retention.
Student recruitment and retention, yeah. So there are a few on there. And that was also, if you're deeply interested in those, I think the list is fully available in the, if you go to the Board of Regents website and you go to their agendas, if you go to their last meeting, you can go into board docs and see the attachments, and that included the original amount. And I don't think there's been a broad communication yet of the rest of it. So we're now kicking into FY18 budget planning process. So we are expecting to be cut again in FY18, so cut again next year. Hopefully the cuts won't be as substantial as they were this year. But just a reminder that each year we have the cuts, we also have rising fixed costs. Those are things like our facilities, our debt, our cost of health care, some other items that go up every year, that there's not a whole lot we can do to shrink that. That's why they're fixed costs. So in addition to any cut we get, we have these rising fixed costs, and that gives us a gap that is greater than any individual cut. So that gap will be continuing as well. We used to have those fixed costs funded annually by the legislature. So now in addition to any cut, we're also not having those funded. So if you saw the Dana Thomas's first sort of forum as chancellor at the beginning of this month, he covered some of that in his slides. And I think we could also have someone, the last few years we've had someone from Office of Management and Budget come do like a 10-15 minute overview on the budget in the fall for staff council, and that would certainly be something we could do in the next two meetings, something like that, sometime this fall, basically, as things get developed. So there are certainly a lot of moving pieces in there, and it can be difficult to keep track of without visuals. So we'll also be updating that Budget 101 infographic that I think you guys got last year with the last year's kind of final numbers. Any questions on budget?
If I could go back for just a moment to the strategic pathways, do we have a timeline for phase two?
Phase two will be fall semester, and then phase three will be the spring semester, basically. And then they'll be done. And so those phases are for things going through the initial review. Implementation for all of those things, which in my head would be the phase two, like this would be group one, group two, group three, but it's phase one when you review things. The terminology is a little muddy. So anyway, each of those will go through their review process this fall and then the spring, and then there will be an implementation timeline for outcomes. And I think those implementation timelines will also vary dramatically depending on, procurement would be a much faster change than school of management. So,
thank you.
Okay. Anything else on budget? And I think Chancellor Thomas will talk about some of these items as well in his comments this morning. Volunteer Day, I think that is something that that committee will be re-engaging with this fall. That was also just sort of an item on hiatus over the summer, sort of going back to that proposal and looking at what might we do instead given the budget climate and the expectations of our community at this time. So I don't think we have anything new on that item right now. Then the transformation team update, we're going to be taking this one off the agenda going forward. Basically, the statewide transformation team, there were some outcomes from that the president communicated, but ultimately the effort now is strategic pathways. And transformation team was really something that the prior president had championed. And so President Johnson's efforts and focus are on strategic pathways as a whole. Any questions on that? And I think it has been mentioned a few times that the goals of those two things are rather different. That statewide transformation team goal was, can we have a smaller statewide administration specifically? Where strategic pathways are where throughout the entire university system can we shrink or consolidate or reorganize? So that has been mentioned, I think, and expressed. So I think that's something to continue to walk toward you during strategic pathways projects, especially on the administrative items. If you end up on any of those teams, also trying to keep a clear view of what should be done at a campus level, what requires that either closer connection to students or faculty, to those kind of mission-centric areas, and then what does make more sense to be done, at statewide. So I think some of those initial questions of transformation team could be useful during the strategic pathways reviews, but transformation team is now closed. All right, Board of Regents public testimony changes. We talked a bit about that. There's attachments here that detail the changes to the process and also for history there. The System Governance Council as a whole did pass a resolution last year supporting the inclusion of off-site testimony. So it's nice to see a resolution that resulted in some changes. I think, as Nate mentioned, this is still a work in progress. So if this format ends up not working well, or if people aren't satisfied with it, they might try a different format. The goal and that resolution in particular was really focused on have some way that people who aren't in Anchorage get to talk to the Board of Regents once in a while.
I'd also point out, in addition to the call-in option, there are public gatherings for, kind of forum and interaction with the Board of Regents and with governance. The first one of those is this Thursday. So for anybody that happens to be in Juneau or wishes to be in Juneau, it's from 5:30 to 7 p.m. this Thursday.
Employee giving initiative.
The employee giving initiative, I think, was we started to take a look at this in response to Interim Chancellor Mike Powers last year suggested this as a component or a complement to the Volunteer Day proposal and different, just kind of seeking out different ways that staff council can organize and promote how much staff people give back to the university. Whether it's our time volunteering for projects or also highlighting the actual like dollars and contributions that we give to university led efforts, charity efforts and that sort of thing. So there's a number of different opportunities I think to give on behalf of the university, especially through the United Way campaign.
and a number of others. The UC Valley Awards usually coincide with an employee with a university giving campaign, and so exploring ways that we can either encourage or kind of consolidate in staff and employee giving, and also to sort of show and to document how much I think staff people are giving in the first place, and so I think that. This came up last year late in the academic term as kind of an exploratory project. I'm not sure if it got very far. Before we were kind of on hiatus and our committees were took a break. But if anybody is eager to participate and think about and kind of figure out this project, I think it's definitely something that the university administration would be thrilled for us to highlight and encourage. And like I said, a lot of it is just kind of communicating, researching and communicating the work and the good charitable contributions that staff people already make. And I think having like an organized way of reflecting that to the university administration and also to the rest of the community would behoove staff council for sure.
I think that if that's something that the University Advocacy Committee is interested in taking up, that would be the natural fit for it in my mind, with the goal of highlighting contributions of staff to the university community. So if you guys want to discuss that at your next meeting, or if you're interested in discussing that at your next committee meeting and want Nate or I to call in or attend, we'd be happy to. Yeah. Single accreditation. So the Nicole has provided in the agenda the link to the accreditation report because it's obviously quite hefty. If you don't have time to read the full report, the executive summary is available and is only a couple pages. So I would encourage everyone to at least read the executive summary. As Chris said in his Faculty Senate report, this is something that Dana Thomas was asked to complete before he was appointed as interim chancellor. So he actually started this before that was even an option or a question when we were still doing a normal chancellor search. So his approach was looking at what is possible with single accreditation, what is possible with three accreditations, what's not possible in either one, sort of outlining what difference does it make to what we want to do if we have single accreditation, and also looking at some sort of common myths that we have adopted as a university. So there are certain things that we say, oh, we can't do that because we have different accreditations, that in fact we could do if we wanted to. So he wanted to debunk some of those things and then focus on what opportunities would it provide and what wouldn't, what could we just do anyway without it. I think the gist of his report was everything that the legislature and the board has been really saying they want the university to do could be done without moving to single accreditation, that's not the barrier we thought it was, and that the effort of moving to single accreditation would be so intense, it would basically tie up all the resources and effort for 2 to 3 years, during which time we wouldn't be able to work on any of that stuff that they actually want to get to, that it could just be essentially a giant distraction, as opposed to working on increasing graduation and access and all those other items, that we can do all of those things without single accreditation. There are some benefits, obviously, to either model, and some cons to either model, but I think his major takeaway was it's not going to be required to get us where we want to go, so maybe don't spend all this time and effort on it. So we'll see. Basically, he finished his report and it was handed off to Vice President Dan White at Statewide to sort of continue with next steps. It'll be presented to the board at their September meeting. I think they'll have a discussion on it, and they'll decide then, do they want to say, no, go ahead with single accreditation? Do they want to say, let's wait till after strategic pathways and then revisit it? Or do they want to say, no, okay, this is enough. We don't need to do any more with single accreditation. So depending on what the board is interested in doing with this report, will have a pretty profound impact. So that's also, if they don't take action on it at this meeting, if they discuss and then postpone action until the next meeting, that's also something for public testimony to consider, especially if you're in an area where you would see those impacts, particularly see those impacts on academic programs or students. Again, that's what really resonates with the board. Any questions on that? I will say, during the process and also at his forum, Chancellor Thomas talked a bit about the role of governance in this report that he had mentioned. With the timeline of the report, he realized that was when governance groups were not meeting regularly, that it was over the summer. He did meet with a couple of us for sort of like, you know, what have you been hearing? What, you know, what are your thoughts on this? And so I shared with him, one, people don't really know enough about what it would look like to say, here are my thoughts on it. It's just sort of like vague thing that no one has any idea how that would impact their day-to-day life as an employee of the university, and that it is hard to provide feedback with while it's this very sort of mysterious thing, but that people do have pretty strong associations with their university and not the UA system. You know, I'm a UAF alum. I work for UAF. I care about UAF. I don't really care about UA in general in the same way. Yeah, that's something I hear a lot, is people care about their campus, and that would be something I'd be concerned about in a move to single accreditation, is that sense of identity. There's also a feedback form for single accreditation comments, so I would encourage people to read the executive summary. Then there's kind of further organized into areas, so if there's an area you're particularly interested in, read that section as well and provide feedback. And I think that's probably all there is to say on that for now, unless there are any questions or comments. Finally, we need a representative for the People's Endowment Board. So this is a committee that meets approximately twice each semester. You have to, outside of those meetings, do some reading in preparation, and then you are required to submit a report to staff council for each meeting. And the People's Endowment Board, remind me, is there's this endowment of money, and if there are really good ideas from the campus community about, you know, if we had this piece of tech in this classroom, we could do this thing, or if we had this in our office, we could transform this service in this way. Proposals like that come in for this funding, and this board decides basically which to fund. So it could be a fun one to be involved in. So any volunteers for that committee? No one? Okay, great.
Wait, what was that?
She said she's interested, but she'd like to think it over.
I can give you more information. Stay here.
Okay. Great. So, yeah, if you guys have questions, you can ask Brandy or Nicole. Maybe both Brandy and Nicole would be good. And then if you decide you're interested, let Nicole know or let me know, and we'll figure it out from there. I think we have time actually now for a 10-minute break. I feel like it's been a long morning already talking at everybody, so sorry for that. Let's take a 10-minute break. Okay, so coming back from break, thank you guys. Next up is staff achievements and highlights. Wanted to just take a moment to recognize and thank Evelyn Pinsgard. It's my understanding that this is Evelyn's last meeting with us. She's been on staff council for several terms as a rural rep, which I think all the normal challenges of participating in governance and finding that time and putting it in are just extraordinarily harder at our remote campuses and rural sites. And I just wanted to thank Evelyn for her commitment to staff council over this time and for her service, and say she'll be missed.
Also, this feels like it's been a while ago for me since I was made aware of it over and over for a very good reason. But our own Sue Mitchell, as well as Kristen Tim and Teresa Bacher, won a very prominent award at the Public Relations Society of America, Aurora Awards, in August for their communications and outreach plan for Arctic Science Summit Week this past March. So congratulations to them, and in particular to Sue.
Oh, thanks. But I should say that was really a big team effort, and while Kristen and Teresa and I presented it at the PRSA, and you know, we did a presentation, University Relations was the one who put in the application for the award, and there was a whole team of communications people involved in putting together the communications plan. So that's definitely a big team effort.
Thanks, Sue, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Any other staff achievements or highlights that people want to share?
Yeah, I had one. Leah Gardine from my office was instrumental in organizing a big open house for the HAARP facility down in Gacona. It was a smash hit success. We had about 350 people showed up, kept us just running all day long. We had a lot of different displays and lectures and interactive things, and it was a really big hit. And about 20 people from GI staff, people involved in making that happen. And then also last week in the Permafrost Expo group, we have a grant for outreach on permafrost, and those folks put together a great thing at the Morris Thompson Center, and they had about 450 people from Fairbanks come and learn about permafrost, and that was a really neat event as well.
That's awesome. I think I saw a headline for the HAARP event promoting it, and it was something like, it's not about mind control, we swear.
Yeah, the ADN said, yeah, we were going to prove that we couldn't do mind control.
Yes.
It's sort of proving the negative.
That's great. Any others? Any online? Great. Well, thank you guys for sharing. It's always good to hear these and to recognize them. So with that, I'd like to welcome Interim Chancellor Dana Thomas and turn it over to him for Chancellor's remarks. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me back there? Okay. Some of you know me, some of you don't, so I thought I'd give a quick introduction. And then I've got a list of items to discuss with you, I suppose. So I started as a first of all, I guess I was born and raised in Fairbanks, so I know Fairbanks very well. I did my bachelor's degree here. I went outside to graduate school, completed a master's and doctorate, and returned to the faculty in 1981. That's when I first started on the faculty at UAF. Worked 30 years at UAF in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics and Computer Science back then, and over time the title of that department has changed. I was 6 years as department chair, 6 years as vice provost, and then after 30 years at UAF, I became the vice president of academic affairs and research at UA Statewide. So I finished up there with 33 and a half years with the university system. Retired for a year and a half, and saw this year as a pivotal year in UAF's history, and so I put my my name forward as one of the possibilities to serve as interim chancellor. And as you know, I was selected for that opportunity. Happy to do it. I do believe this is a pivotal year because of both the sequence of budget reductions that have occurred and the strategic pathways effort that's going on. And I thought that my experience and background would help in that conversation. So that's really why I'm here, all right, and happy to do it. I've got a few items of good news for you, and then I want to spend a few minutes talking about strategic pathways, single accreditation, budget guidance that we've received, and enrollment. And so I'll move very quickly through these and then see if you have questions. All right. How much time can I take?
You can take as long as you want.
Okay. So first, some good news. So I asked this morning, we have Alumni Drive under construction, right? And it's bumpy. It's a struggle to come through. I've driven that very often, of course, as I'm sure many of you have. So I asked, what's the story there? And here's the story that I got from Scott Bell this morning. To accommodate construction on the new heat and power plant, Alumni Drive has been temporarily shifted north. The temporary driving surface is constructed of low-cost, recycled asphalt. Construction adjacent to Alumni Drive is scheduled to be completed by September 25th. At that time, the temporary driving surface will be removed and Alumni Drive returned to normal. So our target date is the 25th, so before the snow flies. So that was very good news from my perspective. So I thought you would want to hear that and to share, help spread the word on that one. You all probably received the notice on the water yet again, and I can tell you that we have completed the shift to College Utilities. Our water source is there now, and so the flushing of the old water source continues, and that'll take some time. We're required to report 5 quarters of information on water, and so we're expecting some shift in the quality of the water as those 5 quarters of time passed under the new water system, and so we're anxiously watching that as you all are. So just wanted to share that. With that, I'll move to strategic pathways. I hope you're engaged and following and looking at those options and providing your feedback on the collection of options. If you have options that you think were not raised, feel free to submit those as well. There's a UA statewide website for that purpose, and I encourage you to share your thoughts in that arena. To remind you, Phase 1, which largely occurred this summer and the options are posted, have to do with the College of Engineering, the School of Management, the School of Education, Information Technology, Procurement, Research Administration, and the one that drew all of the public ire, Athletics. I'm expecting a few announcements with regard to decisions to be made this week at the Board of Regents meeting. We have not yet received those from UA Statewide. We're anxiously awaiting those, as are many of you. And so I'm at least anticipating that there will be, maybe 2 or 3 that get decided, but we don't know yet. So like you all, we're anxiously awaiting those. So those that are not addressed this week at the September board meeting, we would expect some action on at the November meeting. So that's what we've been told, and so I'm just sharing that information. I can tell you UAF's leadership team actively engaged in this, gave our feedback on all of the options with regard to cost, access, quality, and sustainability of each of those over time. And we provided both sort of a ranking of all of those options with regard to those qualities and specific comments. And so that's been the approach of the leadership team in responding to these, just so you've heard that. Phase 2, we've been asked for to submit names for the Phase 2 collection. We have done that. I'm not sure I have the full list here, so Kari may be able to help me with that, but I'll rattle off the ones that I know. So that list is health, which is a very broad area, including not just nursing, but allied health and a whole collection of things that cut across the system. Fisheries, which is a very curious one because UAF already has the lead on fisheries, so this is really about how much fisheries is offered down in Juneau, and we've already reached agreement to offer the undergraduate fisheries degree in cooperation with Juneau down in Southeast Alaska. So we're hoping that one is already dealt with, but we're anxious to see what the options and recommendations are for that one. Community campuses. This is a very big deal for us because we have, of course, a collection of community campuses, some here local with CTC and some in rural locations. One of the possibilities listed there is having all of the community campuses under one of the universities, not scattered as they are, reporting to different universities. And so that one we're quite anxious about and looking forward to the options and providing feedback on that one. Human resources is on this list, and you know, I can anticipate that they might look at centralization of human resources with shared services occurring broadly. That's a fairly common model that gets adopted. But we'll see what those options are. And then student affairs, again, a very, very broad area that, you know, I'm not sure what they might have in mind there for financial aid, registration, judicial kinds of elements with, like, the dean of students elements. You know, there's a whole broad range of areas under student affairs. And so, you know, we're anxious to see what the refinement of the scope is there by the working committees and what the options that they lay out also. Then I just remembered another one, and that is university relations. And I think that's the whole list. E-learning. How could I forget that?
And IR, institutional research.
Oh, yes, and IR. Thank you for looking those up. So e-learning and institutional research. So the last three are university relations, e-learning, and institutional research. We are anxious on, I suppose, all of those for a variety of reasons. E-learning, there statewide appears to be looking for greater cooperation there and collaboration in that effort. There's some room for that, I would say, but I don't see a whole lot of room for greater efficiency there because the vast majority of students are enrolled in Gen Ed there, you know, math, English, communication, et cetera, and virtually all of those sections are full, so there really isn't much competition. There could be a little bit more coordination there, but I'm not sure that it would gain us much efficiency. That's my own view on it. Institutional research, of course, statewide has an IR unit. UAF has a wonderfully progressive IR unit, I would say. Much more scattered institutional research at UAA and a very, very small operation at UA Southeast. So unclear what the approach might be there. You know, I can imagine a variety of scenarios, but some sense of centralization, some sense of specialization probably is part of that conversation, in my guess. So with that one, I think I'll, and so on phase two, that will finish this fall. Again, teams coming up with options. And we'll all have an opportunity to provide feedback on those options. I'm working to get, you know, I wasn't here for phase one. I started in mid-August. Work was pretty well done. So we provided, the leadership team and I provided significant feedback on that, as I said. I'm going to be more progressive, more direct, I think, in the involvement. I'm trying to lay out ideas for options now for that phase two so that we are controlling part of the conversation in advance You know, if you have thoughts on that, please share those with leadership. All very valuable. So I'm expecting phase two probably would not be dealt with at all by the board or announcements until the March meeting. They're unlikely to bring them up at the January retreat. I don't know that yet. We haven't seen an agenda for that. But my guess is the first action on that will occur in March. Then we have a phase three group in the spring, and that probably would be dealt with at the June meeting, is my guess. A little bit awkward because we have guidance, initial guidance, I'll say, from the governor's office on the budget for next year. We've been asked to plan on two scenarios for the university, a 5% reduction and a 10% reduction from this fiscal year. I'm a bit more optimistic on that front, I'll say, than going there, given the action that we saw between the House and Senate in the legislature this last year, and the conference committee actually added to the budget that both of those did. And so I'm hopeful that we have good defenders in the legislature, and we may not have to deal with the 5 or 10%, but we do need to prepare ourselves for it in the event that that occurs. That's got some awkward elements because we're doing that at the same time that Strategic Pathways is underway, and we don't want to show our hand too much during that process because those things might just be taken as part of that process. And so we need to be very strategic in how we behave this year with regard to budget planning. Okay? So I'll pause there a moment to see if you have questions about Strategic Pathways, and then I'll march on to single accreditation and a brief update on enrollment.
Any questions in the room? Any questions online?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, you're allowed.
Okay. I'll just maybe step to the table.
It's okay.
Talk loud. We got
work.
Not for the people online. Please use the mic.
Thanks. Thanks for accepting being interim chancellor. I'm very happy about that, and I know lots of other people are as well. My question or observation, at least at this point, is there a search process underway for a permanent chancellor? And two, or maybe an extension of that, is would you consider being a candidate for a permanent chancellor? We had an interim chancellor in this past year. Mr. Powers did, I think, an excellent job, but he was very clear from the start that it was only going to be for a year. I'm very happy that you've accepted an interim position, but from the outside, within UAF, I think we know you because you've been here before, as was Chancellor Powers. But from the outside, looking into UAF, 2 years with an interim chancellor in a current fiscal situation doesn't look like a very confident UAF. And that concerns me. It also concerns some other staff members, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for saying what you did about my candidacy and willingness to take the position. I appreciate that. So I'm struggling a little bit here because the president – so first I'll answer your question specifically. There is no ongoing search for permanent chancellor at this time, okay? And I would certainly inform you of that if that occurs, all right? The president made this position or continued it as interim because they were looking at single versus separate accreditation, right? And he wasn't sure what the need would be if we moved to single accreditation. And I'll talk a little bit more about the report that I wrote as a private contractor this summer in just a moment. But that is still on the table. And so he can't start a search until some sort of decision or action has occurred on that, because that's what continued the interim position. There will be a discussion of single versus separate accreditation this week at the board meeting in Juneau. I'll be in the hot seat answering questions about my report. And I am hopeful that the board will, at that point, take it off the table, but that's their call. They can decide to pursue single accreditation, they can decide not to pursue it, or they could delay a decision, right? I mean, those are sort of the options that one would expect. If you know, that decision will have a play in this process. There's also an element of, you know, we just ran a search last year, and we got down to four candidates. We interviewed them. They did their public interviews, et cetera, presentations, et cetera. And then we said, oh, sorry, we're not going to do it. So running a search this year would have some awkwardness, as you might guess, right? And so may very well, if they decide to go, if the board and the president decide to go with a permanent chancellor, that they could delay a year. And that would be a conversation that the president would have to have with me and my wife, by the way, about continuing. And we will keep an open mind on that. I'll say that. Okay? We're back because we want to, you know, we saw the same issues you did. A second interim, you know, we didn't want somebody coming in that had a steep learning curve, all of those different elements that you addressed. And so we'll keep an open mind. But I don't want to show my hand, so to speak, because this is really the president and the board's call, right? And it needs to be their call. And so I don't want to influence that in one particular direction or another. So that's why I'm being a little hazy on that. Okay? Is that fair?
Right. Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Any other questions before we move on to the single accreditation part of Chancellor Thomas's remarks?
All right. So before this interim chancellor role came up, President Johnson asked me as a private contractor if I'd be willing to assess single versus separate accreditation for the UA System's three universities. There's a handful of us in the state that have institutional accreditation background that could write this report. Paul Reichert is a good example. He could have written this report. You know, he's a retired provost. The rest of the folks other than me are all employed by the university. Susan Hendricks could write this. She's been an evaluator for the commission. Sam Gingrich, the provost at UAA. Rick Caulfield, the chancellor at UA Southeast. So there's a handful of people, as I said, that have reviewed other institutions for institutional accreditation and worked with the commission over a long enough period to really understand the standards and eligibility requirements for institutional accreditation. And so, you know, he came to me, asked if I would do it, and I said yes. And worked on it over the course of the summer, and that report is available online. And it's a long report. It's about 75 pages. If you haven't looked at it, I will encourage you to read the first three pages, which is an executive summary. And then there are three letters in the appendix that I solicited the opinion of three external experts. And so, you know, if you want kind of a quick study on this, those first three pages of executive summary and those three letters in the back is what I would recommend. If you have a particular interest in some area, research administration, there is a section on research. If you have an interest in community campuses, there is a section on community campuses. And so you can just do a keyword search effectively at that point and go to the specific section that you might have a specific interest in. So there's a lot of gory detail in there, because the president was looking for the limitations or constraints that the university would have to operate under separate accreditation versus single accreditation. And I will tell you there's a lot of space under both, and it really is how either is implemented. There are relatively few real hard line constraints, and I did my best to point out where those were. And the executive summary outlines what I think the pros and cons are of the two different approaches. The conclusion that I reached is that single accreditation is neither necessary nor sufficient to achieve significant cost savings or improve performance measures like completion rates or college going rates or things like that. And so that's the conclusion I reached. And so you all can reach your own conclusion and, again, provide feedback. There's a form on the statewide website for doing that. And so, you know, whether you agree or disagree with me, you're welcome to provide that input to the board and the president. And that window is still open for you to do so. I'm, again, hopeful that window will close with this board meeting, but that's, you know, really the board's call. Are there questions about single versus separate accreditation? How many of you, I'm just curious, how many of you have looked at the report? A few of you? Oh, good. Yeah. Very good. Real leadership here. It's wonderful.
So, sorry, are you expecting action from the board at the September meeting or discussion and then potential action on the November?
So there's a discussion on the board. The president has told me he will make a recommendation to the board on this, but he has not told me what the recommendation will be. And so, you know, like you, I'm anxious to see that. Again, it could be one of those three, I think, are the likely recommendations, right? Enrollment, I wanted to speak with you about UAF enrollment briefly. I get a report on this each Monday as the term is fleshing out. And UAF as a whole is down about 6% in enrollment. That sounds tough, but our sister institutions at UAA and UA Southeast are down further than that, significantly further than that. The Fairbanks campus is relatively flat, almost unchanged. It's like minus 0.2%, so almost no change there. There's some good news in this. We have a number of units, both engineering and School of Management are up. Our UA Scholar enrollment is up, and the Kuskokwim campus enrollment is up. And so there's some good news for certain campuses and certain colleges and schools, and some challenging news. CTC is probably the unit that is facing the greatest challenges in enrollment at this time. And that's true across the state, that enrollments are challenged for career and technical vocational kinds of programs at this time. So with that, I think I'll pause again and see if there are any questions about anything that I've discussed or any more general questions. And then I think I'd like to turn it over to Kari, and she can talk to you a little bit about gender inclusiveness.
So any final questions for Chancellor Thomas before Kari's comments? Anyone online?
There is one thing I want to say, and that is, I agree that Interim Chancellor Powers did a nice job, particularly on the Title IX work, but also in holding, open forums, leadership forums, he called them, and giving people a chance to ask questions and continue the dialogue on issues, getting your feedback. I intend to do that same thing. I intend to come to governance regularly all three governance groups. I intend to hold the public forums. I held one on August 31st. Some of you likely came to that. I will make those a little bit more targeted, I think. So, for instance, I'll be asking Kari to arrange for me to hold one just down at physical plant so I can hear what the issues are down at physical plant. Hold one up on West Ridge so that I can get feedback from West Ridge. And then hold one that's particularly for the community campuses, largely audio-driven like this, so that we have an opportunity for their direct input and questions. So if you have ideas or thoughts on that, how to make that most effective, I would welcome that. But engaging with shared governance and providing ample opportunity for questions and input during this, again, rather pivotal year is vital to our success. So I want to make sure that I'm doing the right thing there.
Thank you. And there was actually one question online.
Okay.
Is there a plan to help increase the tech reg? Leslie, do you mean the registration, student registration at Community Technical College? Yes. Okay. So, yeah, is there a plan to address that declining enrollment at CTC?
We've the leadership team, including Michelle Stalder, have drafted an initial plan to improve enrollment overall, and there are elements of it related to CTC in there. There's some opportunities for both some new programs and the expansion of some programs that will increase, have good potential to increase enrollment. And so we will be putting out a draft for comment and suggested revision here soon. That is one of our key elements. I guess I will point out to you that all of us are potential recruiters for UAF, right? And it's that relationship with both students, their parents, and potential students that make a difference in our ability to attract and retain students. So we all play a significant role. So we'll be providing very specific guidance on how you might play in that effort here fairly soon. That's all part of this effort. So the answer to the question online is yes.
Leslie asked a second question, it looks like, relating to tuition for tech-level classes as well.
Their follow-up. Is there the possibility for lower tuition for tech classes?
There is. This is an ongoing discussion. When I was in the vice president's role up at Statewide, I raised the possibility that at some point we need to make a separation in tuition because while tuition for baccalaureate students is UAF and UA as a whole is low compared to our peers and even low nationally, which makes us a good value. In fact, we often get reported as a strong value by national comparisons. That's not true for certificate and applied associate programs. And so there's ongoing conversations, no decisions as of yet, but ongoing conversations about the possibility of raising baccalaureate tuition and at least holding voc-tech kinds of programs, particularly certificates and occupational endorsements, at their current tuition, so they would not rise. So there would be a separation over time. That's just a conversation at this point, and so we've got to let that conversation play out. If you have opinions on that, we would love to hear it. I personally believe that Alaska does need that low-cost option for post-secondary ed as we move forward, again, I'm open to input and what challenges that creates for our various campuses as well.
Thank you. And so I just
I want to be respectful of your time, too. And if you need to leave for your next meeting, feel free to just
thank you.
Take
I'm
off
whenever
you want.
Check the time. Oh, I am quite late already. So I think I'll head back and I'll let Kari address the gender inclusiveness, if that's all right. So thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for the questions. And I look forward to future dialogue with you all.
Thank you very much for spending the time with us this morning.
Okay, I know you have a full agenda today, so I'll try to be quick on this. I wanted to give, actually, let me back up. I'm Kari Burrell. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Administrative Services. I know most of you, but not all of you, so I wanted to do that quick intro. When the Chancellor and I were talking about sort of the key issues that we're working on for this next year and talking through, he wanted to hit most of those. And then there is one additional issue, which is we have a project we're working on to improve gender inclusiveness at UAS. And I'm leading a work group on that. So I wanted to give you a little bit of background on that, just so you're aware of it. There will be some more communication coming out later this week. In May, UAS and every other university in the country got a letter from the federal government, one of their dear colleague letters is what they call them, dear colleague. And it's usually when they tell us, these are some new rules that you need to follow or abide by. And this letter that we got in May was a letter saying, under Title IX, which is the law, the federal law that guarantees equal access to educational programs for folks regardless of gender, they wanted to let us know that they are interpreting that to mean gender identity as well, which means if I am a student or an employee and I'm in particular, in the letter, they called out transgender students and employees. If I'm transitioning to a different gender, that is protected under Title IX. And so we got this letter, and they wanted us to be sure that we are being making sure that those students' employees have equal access to our programs. And when we got that letter, my initial reaction was no problem. We already have anti-discrimination policy at UAF and UA system-wide that says we will not discriminate based on gender identity, gender orientation, any of those things, sexual orientation. So I thought initially we were probably in pretty good shape. I don't think that we really care what gender you are in terms of going through your educational program or for employment purposes. I think that's sort of a non-issue. But when we started taking a look at this a little bit more, and we did put a group together, I am realizing that there is a difference between non-discrimination and actually being inclusive and making people feel welcome on campus. And I do think we have more work to do in that area. So we have a number of activities underway, starting with just basic forms. Are we asking people to click a box that's just male, female, and maybe we need to provide some additional options because that doesn't describe everybody? We are taking a look at policies and looking to see if the language is just really binary in there or whether it's more inclusive. And an example I have is for the university firefighter program for students, we did have a policy outlining bunking arrangements down at the station number 2, which is the one down on University Avenue. And it just described, basically students need to be prepared to share a room because you're bunking overnight. But it just talked about men and women may have to be in the room together. And so we just are changing that language to say, regardless of gender, you will be sharing a room and you need to dress appropriately, basically. That's that policy. So we're taking a look at our forms. We're taking a look at our policies. And one of the bigger things that we're going to need to take a look at is our facilities. And just historically, traditionally, we have kind of divided the world into two categories, men and women. We have restrooms for men and women, and we have locker rooms for men and women, and we have shower rooms for men and women. And we need to think about creating spaces that are accessible to folks who are less binary in their gender choices. And so we are right now going through a process. We have a lot of single stall restrooms on the universities, and we're going to re-sign those because it's really not necessary to say this one's for women and this one's for men. It really doesn't matter once you're in there. So we're changing the signs on the restrooms. We're going to have to do a little bit more work on the locker rooms and shower rooms too. make people, to make them such that everybody feels comfortable using them. And so there probably will be some physical redesign of some of the restrooms and locker rooms on campus. We'll take some more time to do. But I think the biggest issue for us is really just education and awareness for our students and for our employees, both staff and faculty. And we're going to have to spend some more time thinking about creating just tools that people can access, a website with materials and educational opportunities for folks. And so we're not really ready with that. We're still working on kind of outlining what that might look like. And so one of the things I wanted to bring, we started working on this over the summer when the governance groups weren't basically active. And so I wanted to kind of put out here for this group to think about whether you want to have somebody participate on the planning group. And then just basically let you know that this is an effort that's underway, and we're going to be working on it throughout the year and hopefully making more progress on some of these things, and we can report out periodically. So that's just all I wanted to do, is share that this work is underway.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Kari?
I did have two quick questions. One, I am interested in whatever, I don't know what Faye wants to do, but just so Faye knows, I'm interested in that. And the second was interesting. So in my main work, I was working on making sure our housing software could handle a different type of gender coming to the banner and things like that on the technical side. And I just noticed when we were meeting with a software company that there was a lot of people on the call. And it finally came up that we were curious why so many people were on the call. And it was like other institutions aren't actually even there yet. They're not even looking at this. We're seeing UA system seems to be way in front of the curve on this subject in the Dear Colleague letter and the response. And I was just curious, I guess, how much we're looking at it. Is there any actual best practices, like in professional organizations or anything coming out yet? I was just kind of curious.
I think you're correct. I mean, there are some universities that have given this a little bit more thought, not from an institutional perspective, but there are universities that have really strong gender equity, either student service organizations or employee organizations. And so those universities have done some thinking about this. And actually, we are looking at some of their materials that they're putting out, at least in terms for training purposes. I don't know that there are many universities that are much farther ahead of us in terms of, like you said, the information systems, the physical facilities, and some of the policies. I don't think that we're really much farther behind than anybody else. And you're right, we're out pushing on some of this in some areas. For example, the banner system that we use is a product that's used by many universities in the country. We were starting to think about, well, maybe we should reprogram that. And finally, Ellucian, which is the company that makes this, is like, well, gosh, this is something that's going to affect every university. Maybe we, the company, should be thinking about how we redesign the program. But they're looking to universities to give them thoughts. And so we've been thinking about it all summer long, so we're giving them our thoughts. But I think it's going to take a while, 6 months or so, probably, for them to get their fix in place. And I don't think that's different on facilities. People are asking us, what are you doing? Can you share your materials? And they're asking us, what are you doing on your forms? And can you share your materials? So I think universities are kind of going through this slowly. I don't think there is best practice organizations out there yet on this issue.
Great. Thank you.
And we have a question online. Chris? Yep.
Okay. I just have a question. What are the current policies and procedures in place that the university can sit on concerning this gender identity? How do you handle if a student comes to you and files a complaint if you're a member of the opposite sex in a restroom and you find out that person is a transgender? What are the current policies and procedures to handle this situation?
That is a good question, because we looked at, do we want to create new policies? And I think at this point we're looking at, we have a non-discrimination policy that says everyone is going to be treated basically the same regardless of gender identity or gender or sexual orientation. And we don't see a need to change that policy. We do have an office. We have a couple of offices that look into complaints. complaints. And so there's the Office of Diversity and Equal Opportunity that takes a look at complaints. If somebody feels that they are not being treated the same because they're in a protected class, we need to look into those. And so they will take a look at some complaints. And then the Dean of Students Office sometimes gets complaints from students that they take a look at. So in the instance that you just provided, I think we do need to do, honestly, some more training around when it, who should use which restrooms, because basically what the federal government has said is the person themselves gets to decide what their gender is, and then they, based on that, will use the restroom that seems most appropriate to them. That may be very confusing to other folks who might look at that person and say, I don't think you're in the right restroom. It's not really appropriate for me to say to somebody else which restroom that they should be using. So we need to do some more education on that, and that will be something that we'll be working on this fall, not just for the folks on the university campus, but we have a lot of people from town who come up and use our facilities, and so we're aware that we're going to have to do a sort of an education campaign about what the university's approach is going to be on this.
Thank you.
I had a couple of staff people at the Geophysical Institute asked me to bring this up to at the staff council, so it's timely that you're here. The LV building has recently been re-signed. The restrooms and the single stall restrooms were re-signed as gender neutral. And the issue these two staff members had was that the effect of it was that almost all of the women's bathrooms were the ones that were re-signed and the men's ones were not. So there are now 4 floors of the LV building out of the 7 that have no women's dedicated women's restrooms, but they do have men's restrooms and gender-neutral restrooms. So they felt that that was not equal treatment for the women, and also they had an issue with that there was no notification, no discussion, just they arrived one day and all those signs. So they asked me to bring that up. So perhaps you could address that.
No, thank you, Sue, for that feedback. We are aware that the signing happened before the communication did. So the signing has been put on hold for right now, the re-signing. There will be communication that goes out this week explaining that. I do think that's a separate issue from your question about whether there's going to be an appropriate balance of the numbers of restrooms that are for women and for men and then for that are non-gendered. And so we need to take a look at that. I don't know what's going on in LV that you would have. It sounds like you have some gang restrooms that are big enough.
Yeah, well, there were, and I haven't been in the men's rooms, but my understanding is that most of the men's rooms on these floors have more than one stall. And at the women's rooms were the ones that had only one stall. So those were probably the ones that were chosen to become gender-neutral ones because they have, locking doors. But then the effect is that it's an uneven thing. And the suggestion was perhaps that there didn't need to be a gender-neutral bathroom on every floor, that, in a 7-story building you could put a gender-neutral restroom on every other floor, perhaps, or something along those lines. And, the LV building was built in the 70s, and there were probably 90% men working there then. And, so you can see where this might have come from, and it may not be an issue as much in other buildings on campus. But
right. So, and I think that's actually a perfectly valid question, and so we'll take that up with design and construction and see if they are balancing out sort of numbers as they go through this.
I think there was one more question, and then we'll have to move on because we do have a lot left on the agenda to get through today.
I just wanted to applaud your effort to go above and beyond the Dear Colleague letter.
Thank you. Agreed.
Yes.
Yeah, it feels good to be out in front on big issues like this. So thank you, Kari, and thanks for taking the time today. Okay, so moving on to new business. First up, this is just sort of a housekeeping item. We had the August meeting was canceled. We did that poll for availability. Looked like availability didn't really support having a meeting at that time. Executive board, which had been given the authority for the summer, cancel that meeting, and we would just like to formally ratify that by the whole body so that it's not just executive board willy-nilly canceling meetings and hoarding power. So that motion is attached. It's 274-1. So if anyone would like to, I guess the motion has been made because it's there. And it came from executive board. So it came from committee, so it doesn't necessarily need a second. So then, does anyone have any comments or concerns with that? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Hearing and seeing no opposition, the motion passes. Thank you. The next up is a meteor item, essentially. Normally, we run our fall election voting period once nominations are in and we open up the voting period. It's usually open for 30 days. People don't really vote over the course of the full 30 days. They vote when it opens, and then they vote when they're told it's about to close, with not much action in between. The timeline for that then means that we're sort of scrambling to get people cleared and onboarded and checked and all that right before the holiday break and get all that ratified so that then we can get them on board in the spring. And it just sort of makes this time crunch that, especially now with an elections committee of one, and Nicole has had a contract reduction as well this year, that is just looking like much more of a challenge this year than normal. And so there is a motion from the Elections Committee to amend the Staff Council bylaws to shorten that fall voting period to 15 days instead of 30 days, thinking that we'll still give people opportunity to participate, we'll still do the reminders, but that the majority of the voting happens, could happen easily within a 15-day window. And so that motion is attached as well. So I'd like to open that item up for discussion. Are there any concerns? Okay, I see a comment from Chris. Thank you. Last call for open discussion of concerns with shortening the period, if anyone wants to speak to that.
Just a question, is it 15 working days or 15 days?
15 days. So
okay.
It's open for 2 weeks. Leslie, well, the same thing we do if we don't get wide participation during 30 days, which is actually pretty normal already, which is we go based on the participation we have. I think, you know, what we could do is if participation drops dramatically this year when we make the change, we could change back. There's nothing holding us to this in perpetuity, but yeah.
Another comment is that this would allow the bylaws to say a minimum of 15 days.
We
could extend it if we needed to.
That's an excellent point. Yes, thank you for catching that. That slipped my mind. So, yeah, if we needed to extend, we could, if there were concerns. We're just not saying we absolutely need to have it open for a minimum of 30 days. So.
Yeah, can I make a quick comment,
yeah,
too? I wish Trish was here because she could explain it much better, but this also kind of gives us some breathing room in case we have a tie, which hasn't not happened in the past, but could happen. So that buys time if we need to have a runoff, which before we didn't have that period after voting.
And actually, Trish is online and made that correction to me. Thank you, Trish, that the membership or the motion is actually from the membership and rules committee, not the election committee. Trish, did you have anything you wanted to add? It doesn't look like there's a muted thing on you.
We don't think we've muted you, Trish. I think she's typing it in. Okay. Right. Yes. Yep.
And we can still send out that reminder.
Yeah.
We just don't have 3 weeks to do it.
Right. All this downtime in the middle. Okay. Okay, so I'd like to move this to the vote then. I think we've had some discussion. So since this is a bylaw amendment, it will require a roll call vote. So, Nicole?
Chad?
Yep.
Do we need a motion to add additional days if necessary, and who can make that call? Can we make, do we need the staff council to make that call? Can we do it for the bureau votes, or would the executive board have that power?
I think the elections committee could keep it open. It's not explicit, but I think this specifically just says it's a minimum of 30 days, so the election committee could, if it was for some reason needed, if we had one of those weeks was a winter storm and we were iced up the whole time and everyone was home for a week, then, we could continue. So
last year the software crashed in between.
That's right.
So
that's right. We did extend it last year without
extended it to meet that 30-day deadline because it was what the bylaws required. And to go back and figure out exactly how much time the software had been down was nearly impossible the way it's written. So we made sure that it was adequate to meet that requirement. We're not trying to take time away from people voting.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think to answer your question, the election committee could just accept it if needed. It's just that we're setting the minimum at 15 days. Okay. So the roll call vote.
Chad? Carrie's not here. Leslie? Alda? Jamie? Is Jamie still up there? I don't think. Sue?
Aye.
Wendy? Chris?
Aye.
Jane?
Aye.
Matthew?
Aye.
Susie? Stacy?
Aye.
Randy?
Aye.
Yeah, Katie's not here. Jessica Armstrong?
Aye.
Emily Nelson? I don't think Emily's here. Kara?
Aye.
Dean?
Aye.
Jessica Allard?
Aye.
Kim?
Aye.
Brad?
Yes.
Thanks, Brad. Lena?
Aye.
Janelle? China?
Aye.
Melissa?
Aye.
Trish? Thanks, Trish. Connie? Samara? Unanimously passed.
All right, the motion passes unanimously. Thank you all. The next item is more just a point of information. So there are three units at UAF that are using furlough this year, the office management and budget. We're doing a furlough, the library is doing a furlough, and environmental health, safety, and risk management is also doing a furlough. And so one of the things that came up there, the implementation of the furlough to staff as opposed to executives is a new process this year that they're sort of working through in HR. How do you do that in the system, and how do we track it? And right now it's done differently for exempt and non-exempt employees, salaried and hourly employees. Salaried employees, there's the option of having a reduction to your base pay. So every paycheck is a little bit smaller, and then you use a dummy code basically throughout the year to track, yes, I took X number of days. Whereas with, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong on this point, those of you who are experiencing it, for non-exempt employees, hourly employees, it's more a code where you actually leave without pay during that piece. It's not a base salary reduction. And what we've now realized as part of this implementation is that for employees like me, where my base pay has been reduced, I'm charging as a dummy code. It looks like I'm still earning leave during those days. For hourly employees, they're charging to a real leave code for furlough that doesn't accrue leave. In the policy, it says during furlough you do not accrue leave, but because of the way they're trying to figure out how to implement it with salaried staff, it's not being applied equitably between employee types. And so the Staff Alliance Compensation Committee, Brad recognized this and brought it forward. We've had some response from statewide HR, but it seemed like maybe that their approach hadn't necessarily been communicated to UAS HR, and that there was still some kind of confusion about how this would actually be dealt with or applied for this year. On the plus side, it's a very small group of employees affected at this point, so as the administration is trying to figure it out, it's not 2,000 employees that they're trying to figure out in the system how to deal with this, but I think we're still a bit of a test case, those of us who are being furloughed this year. But I just wanted to give people a heads up that that's an issue. That's something that we should be keeping an eye on, because we certainly want to be fair between employee types. And it's something that we raised in pre-staff as well, and we'll be reaching out to try and make sure that there's, one, an official communication about the impacts in the process and how they're going to align those two items, and then that's clearly communicated at both the statewide and UAS HR levels, at least to the employees who are affected this year. Brad, did you have anything to add to that?
Sure. It was actually the impacts of furlough and leave accrual on exempt and non-exempt employees were actually clearly communicated way back when UA first put out the facts, the furlough facts. And I think, so far as I can tell, we all dismissed it then. It was, I think, a year and a half ago. And it said very clearly in those two facts, one for exempt and one for non-exempt, that exempts would accrue leave and non-exempts would lose leave accrual while on furlough. And I just don't think any of those questions then until it was actually implemented, and then we noticed wait a minute. And just to make it clear what the difference is, for a 10-day furlough, that's a 3.8% reduction. If you're an exempt employee, that's what you lose, a 3.8% reduction to your pay over, actually it's from each paycheck. If you're a non-exempt employee, it's also a 3.8% reduction, but because you're not accruing leave, you lose those annual leave accruals. So your total reduction is a 4.1 to 4.2% reduction, depending on how many hours of annual leave you accrue, which depends on your amount of service to the UN. And so that's the issue. And I didn't include sick leave in that because sick leave isn't paid to an employee, it's not owed the same way. So I was just including annual leave with those percentages. I heard through someone who used to be on the competition working group that UA plans to do a true up of leave. But when I followed up with UAFHR, they had heard about it, but they didn't know much about it. And I followed up since then, and I haven't heard anything back yet.
So yeah, I think this is something that we'll probably pursue more at the staff alliance level, since it is sort of a system level piece. But my understanding is actually the only people being furloughed system wide right now are those three UAF units. I don't think UAA, UAS, or statewide is using furlough. They've done things through vacancies and layoffs. But I think, yeah, that's something we're going to try and keep an eye on and get figured out. So hopefully it can be addressed this year with the people who are experiencing it this year, and then be fixed going forward. I just wanted to keep people in the loop on that item. Committee membership. So for internal staff council committees, you know, that our general process is choose whichever committee you're most interested in and go for it. So that's been our process. Right now, though, we have, in elections, we have one chair and nobody else. So Brandy is running elections solo right now. In membership and rules, we have only four members. In rural affairs, we have a chair and three members. Staff affairs, we have two co-chairs and 15 representatives. University advocacy, we have one co-chair and then five representatives. So this is not mandatory in any way, but I'm hoping that perhaps some people who are serving in staff affairs would be either willing to serve on rural affairs, membership and rules, or elections, or if you're really interested in what's going on in staff affairs, also helping out on those committees where you can. I think elections is the most egregious imbalance right now. But those others do a lot of work, too. And I wanted to add, typically people choose rural affairs because they work at rural sites, and that's what draws them to it. But there's a lot of opportunity for people who are on the main campus to also contribute in the Rural Affairs Committee. And it was that way for years, where we had kind of active participation here as well, sort of being allies and advocates and supporting those efforts. And I think it helps that committee, too, to have people who can be physically here. So that's just a plea. No one needs to... We don't need to move people in the meeting right now, but if you could just send an email to me and Nicole about shifting, if you're willing to do that. Or if you have any questions about those committees, just contact the committee chairs, and I think they can tell you all the compelling reasons why you should serve there. Next new item, I was contacted about a week ago. The UA Foundation has been going through all the scholarships and looking at any ones that might not comply with our UAF's non-discrimination category or policy. And we say we will not discriminate against anyone based on protected class. One type of protected class is marital status is something that we can't discriminate on as a university. And so as they were going through things, they saw that the Carolyn Sampson Memorial Scholarship, which is a staff council scholarship, does have preference for a single head of household, for a single parent. It was set up that way in honor of a single parent who went back to school. So we've been having playing a bit of phone tag and trying to have a few more conversations to figure out if that is something that really needs to be changed. But the initial communication was, if you guys are willing to take out that preference and leave everything else the same, that moves this along easily and kind of does it. Otherwise, we have to go through all these really difficult legal channels, but we're moving to changing all these things anyway. So I guess the message I got was, it would be really helpful if we could do this. It will potentially be changing either way because they're changing all of these things from a compliance standpoint. We could have someone, if we had a small group of people who were really interested in this topic or cared very strongly about it, we could set up a meeting with the UIP Foundation person to discuss it further. But otherwise, there is a draft motion attached in that letter, or a motion that they would like us to consider. That's attachment 14. Page 33. Which is, the staff council hereby approves of changes to the agreement governing the Carolyn Sampson Memorial Scholarship, such that the restriction expressing a preference for scholarship recipients to be single as opposed to married is removed. All other restrictions should remain attached. That is what they would like us to pass so that they can move this along. So I guess my plan was to open this up for some kind of general discussion today, see what people wanted to do. I think one way or another we should take action on this at the next meeting, whether it's saying no, which I guess we could say, or saying yes, and if we want a meeting in the meantime with Foundation, then I'd be happy to try and set that up. So, any comments on that? Yeah.
So I'm not familiar with this, so I was wondering, did Carolyn Sampson or her family put this forward as this is how they would like the money, or was it something that the staff council said, hey, we want to do this as a memorial to this person, mm-hmm. and this is how we, so
yeah.
Which way was that?
So staff council set it up in memoriam of Carolyn Sampson, and correct me if I'm wrong, in memoriam of Carolyn Sampson, who was a single parent who went back to school to continue her education when she passed on. Staff council put this scholarship fund together. So it's what they're doing is going back to also like the initial donors. So in places where it's the family put it together, they're going to the family and asking for something in writing. And so because this is a staff council scholarship, they came to staff council.
I don't know if the family donated originally.
I'm not sure. I think staff council did a fundraiser. So this was set up in 1990. So a lot of it is very historical. But I think it was a staff council sort of fundraising item for this scholarship.
Thank you. That helped.
Sure.
So I get the impression, based on what I've heard about other scholarships that they're going through, and it's going to happen either way, like you were saying. So it seems like it makes sense for us just to allow it to change personally, because they're requiring all of that, the discriminatory stuff, to be taken out of any scholarship.
Yeah.
Is this a scholarship?
I'm not sure about the discriminatory part of it, because if you have engineering scholarships, you can't be a drama major and do one of those.
Because that's not that's not a protected class. Marital status is a protected class. Yeah. Sorry, Jane, did you have a...
Is this a scholarship where they have to provide, where somebody reads the essays? Who reads for this scholarship?
Yeah, so the students apply. Foundation sort of, or financial aid, someone does kind of an initial filter for, like, basic eligibility requirements, and then it comes to staff council, and we have a committee each year that picks a winner, basically, out of the applications. So I think, yeah, that's the process.
Yeah, that's the answer.
Yeah.
So would this amendment to it, I'm looking on page 36, the last thing on the thing, it says preference will be given to a single female or male student who is a single head of household. There's two singles in that word.
Committee did not meet, and that's the report, but there needs to be something coming in. And so that's something we always struggle with, is getting those reports, but that's the responsibility of serving on that committee, is communicating back to the broader group whatever's going on with it, even if nothing has happened or nothing has gone on. So just a reminder to please do that. So committee reports, if we can do the super short highlights for any of those, since we are way over time. I'm sorry about that. Brandy?
So we did not meet because I did not need a meeting with myself. Phil left. If anyone, like Faye said earlier, wants to join elections, we're kind of open. You know, anyone who wants to join. Phil set the software up really good before he left. We're going to roll with the software as is, which is the same software that we've used in years past. And nominations will be opening up on the 15th. So actually this week, nominations will open up. And that's the quick and dirty.
Yeah. So if you're currently a staff council representative and you would like to continue being a staff council representative and your unit is up for election, so which is what, odd? Even?
Odd.
Odd and at large.
Yeah.
Okay. If your seat is up for election this year and you'd like to continue, you do need to nominate yourself or be nominated. Again, you don't automatically get captain. So
and
please
one more
do that.
Quick thing, there's an attachment with the agenda that outlines the new units. I'm sure you guys all remember that we made some changes. Membership and rules were really active in making the changes to get units 9 and units 7 squared away. So everyone take a look at that, because if you are on unit 9 or 7, which are both up for re-election, what your TKL was will determine what unit you're going to be in next year if you choose to stay on staff council. Okay, that's it.
Great. Okay. Membership and rules has June and July reports attached. Is there anything to add from that committee? Oh, excellent. Yes, we're really sad that Trisha's stepped down as chair due to time obligations. Thankfully, we get to keep her on staff council. So if anyone from membership and rules wants to step up to the chair position, please just let us know. If someone from outside of membership and roles is interested in serving as a chair, that's also an opportunity to take a leadership position. That's a really great committee that gets a lot done. So if you're interested in being chair, get in touch.
And then I did want to mention, so the people who are current members are very taxed and are although we debated a lot about internally who would be chair. So we would really love to have somebody else, and it's really just somebody to orchestrate. You don't really have to have a huge base knowledge of membership of rules. So anybody who's interested, even if you're new, to be chair, that would be great.
If you're willing to call a meeting and say, we're meeting now, and then to file a brief report on that meeting, that's the minimum requirement for a chair. I think that's the minimum I did when I was a committee chair a few years ago. So, but it's a good opportunity, and then you're on an executive board as well, so you get to hear from the other chairs. So it's one extra one-hour meeting a month, and then just calling that meeting and making sure it happens. So, yeah, that's a good point, Matthew. You don't need to be an expert in membership and rules to chair that committee. You just have to be willing to convene it. And you can just let us know. Rural Affairs, Chris, I see you did not meet. The next meeting is Wednesday from 2 to 3. I think same goes if you're interested potentially in joining Rural Affairs and bulking up some of those members. You could call into their meeting and get a sense of what's going on there and where you might contribute. So I'd encourage people to do that. Staff Affairs didn't meet since our last meeting. So we'll just move along. And same with University Advocacy. So I just wanted to
We have attached some external committee reports. There were two I wanted to just draw your attention to briefly. That I just encourage you to look at those attachments. The first one was for the Staff Alliance Compensation Working Group. The recommendation that that group put forward, which was that the annual increase this year be partially an across-the-board increase and partially a step, people moving up a step in the grid. That was accepted by the president, so that's how it was applied. So I just want to thank Brad for his work on that as well. That kind of helps us avoid some salary compression where people who have been here for 10 years get paid the same rate as someone who was just hired because they haven't gone up any steps in the meantime. And then the second one with an attachment that I wanted to raise was for the Employee Engagement Subcommittee. There's a communication from the HR director, Brad Lobland, that went to deans and directors about employee engagement. That's on page 9 and 10 and 11 of the agenda. But that includes some ways that they were encouraging deans and directors to support staff in their units or employees in their units. And it includes also the link to the employee assistance program for if you want counseling, if you're stressed, if you're feeling burnt out, if you need assistance. We have these resources available at no cost to employees, so I want to just always encourage people to take advantage of those. And there are some other ideas in there as well. So that was provided to us as a courtesy so we know what they're telling deans and directors as well. All right. So we're going to go off the record for a really brief roundtable. You can just say no comment or type no comment if there's no comment. I'll start online.